This is R.R. Reno from First Things Magazine coming to you today from the studios of Spirit Catholic Radio, KVSS in Omaha, Nebraska. And today I'm joined by Mary Eberstadt, whose piece in the October issue, What Does Woman Want? The War Between the Sexless, is our topic for today. Well, welcome.
Thanks very much, Rusty.
One of the things that really struck me, well, there are many things that struck me in the piece, very funny moments in the piece. I guess it's the nature of male-female relations to bring a chuckle to one's lips. But one of the things that struck me was the unhappiness, or this, I don't know, the sense of angst, unhappiness, regret, bitterness, and so on from these women authors that you survey, especially the piece in The Atlantic by Lowe, Sandra Lowe. Just striking to me, the unhappiness, especially in light of the fact these are very successful people who are writing these things who would seem to have everything going their way. What do you make of that?
Yeah, that's a great question, Rusty. Let me just summarize a little bit for the listeners who may not have seen the piece yet. Over the summer, a series of articles appeared in various Tony places like The Atlantic and in Time magazine, as where kind of following along tradition by now of female confessional literature. That is, it sounds more grandiose than it is. I mean, for several years now, there's been quite a lot of, heartrending stories on the internet and in the better magazines about how unhappy women today are. And over the summer, there were several distillations of this point of view. Now, we're not talking about all women, if you keep in mind the kind of places where these stories are appearing. This looks to be a localized, upper-middle-class, well-educated sort of phenomenon, and that's what got me curious about what the common denominators might be. So for First Things magazine, I surveyed several of these pieces, and it seemed as if they all boiled down to two different complaints. One, women are unhappy because women are tired of being mother and father and breadwinner all rolled into one. That is, women are overtly happy with the kind of post-feminist gender reassignment. And the second complaint, which is, I think, more interesting and unexpected, is that women complain of having marriages without romance, marriage without sex. That's why in the title we use the war between the sexless, because today's women in these rarefied places, at least, seem sexless in two senses. One, it's been de-sexed because the gender roles after feminism have been sort of spread out equally among men and women and have become interchangeable. And two, de-sexed in a literal sense, that by their own account, their marriages are empty of that rather important ingredient. So those were the two common denominators that seemed to be sprinkled through this literature, and those are the two that I focused on in the essay.
Well, let's take the first one, which is this kind of gender role reassignment, and what's going on with that, and the kind of unhappiness, or I don't know how to characterize it, but at least the unsettled ground, because you'd look at Caitlin Flanagan's piece in the New York Times magazine, and it's really a kind of argument that marriage is good for children. Okay, well we've had a lot of studies that show that pretty strongly.
Right, it's not news. I mean, it may be news in some places,
yes.
But to the general reader, it's not news.
Yes, but Flanagan doesn't really deal with this kind of male-female issue about, I don't know, this kind of feeling like, part of me thinks that what's going on is females have accepted gender role reassignment, but males have to a certain extent, but only on the edges. I wonder if you think that's true. I mean, what I mean by that most upper middle class men, yes, of course, help around the house, do your do your home chores and all that kind of stuff. That's accepted now. But their basic sense of what their role in life is hasn't changed all that dramatically, as opposed to a lot of females compared to their, not their mothers, but let's say their grandmothers. Things have changed pretty dramatically. Kind of leaves them a bit adrift in terms of how they're supposed to understand their lives.
Yes. Right, Rusty. I think that's just one of the many ways in which the sexual revolution has actually fallen heaviest on the shoulders of women. And if you just look at pop sociology, contemporary sociology, you see lots of evidence of this. For example, we have this phrase, the second shift, right, that refers to women who are, you know, out in the office or in the workplace all day, coming home and then having a second shift at home where they do all the house cleaning they didn't do and their husbands didn't do and, you know, go over the kids' homework and all of that sort of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
There is nothing analogous in sociology today for men. I mean, men don't talk about a second shift because men don't feel a second shift the same way. I'm not saying there aren't plenty of hardworking guys out there. Obviously, there are. But in making men more like women and women more like men, we seem to have increased the burden on women disproportionately. And I think that's part of what this literature of female complaint is about.
Yeah,
in part, I think, a legitimate reaction to feeling like, hey, you know, I'm supposed to be the nurturer and the breadwinner and the chauffeur and all of these things at
yes.
once.
Yeah.
Of course, a lot of women can't face it quite head on because feminism has told them, yes, that's what feminism is, that you should be all of these things interchangeably with a male.
Mm-hmm.
And never mind that he does some things better than you, and never mind that you do some things better than him. We're all supposed to believe in this, you know, gender-free world. And this is where the trouble starts, I think, in this kind of confessional literature, but only where it starts, really.
Well, I mean, one of the lines that really jumped out at me, I thought was very true in the piece, was your observation that women say they want to have it all or and so on. And I thought about that and thought, men, you're absolutely right. Men don't say that.
No, I don't think they feel the sort of perfectionist drive that women do when handed this challenge of being more...
everything. Yeah.
Yeah. And some, there's other survey data that bears this out, so just incidentally, but it does seem like, on balance, men are happier than women these days. I mean, to judge by the kind of data amassed by sociologists.
Mm-hmm.
So there's something interesting going on there after the feminist revolution and the sexual revolution. After all, it was women that these revolutions were said to liberate primarily. Something's obviously gone wrong.
Another element, too, that jumped out at me was your observation that Sandra Lowe piece, which is in her style, very spicy and kind of over the top. You described it as a condemnation of the metrosexual, or something along those lines. I thought that was a kind of interesting angle. And I'm wondering whether or not, especially upper middle class women, send kind of mixed messages to men about what they really want.
Well, I think that line of thought goes back to Eve, at least.
You're right.
There is something particularly different about the way they do it now. Let me, again, just fill in the listeners quickly. The essay that I was talking about and that Rusty's talking about appeared in The Atlantic by a well-known writer, Sandra Thing Lowe, saying that she was divorcing, and not only was she divorcing, about which she gives many more particulars than you ever wanted to know, what your kids would call PMI,
yes,
too much information, but not only is she divorcing, but she has decided that marriage itself is impossible. And so, in addition to telling her own story, she tells the stories of various friends of hers whose marriages are also allegedly, you know, without romance, sexless and boring and stifling and all of that stuff. Now, the reason the word metrosexual comes into play here is that if you listen to what she says and listen to what her friends are allegedly saying, it all comes down to the same thing. You know, they don't want to be challenged in the kitchen by their husbands. And they want husbands who have more, you know, savoir-faire, you know, and more sort of traditionally masculine virtues. And why is this interesting? Because they don't realize that what they're describing is a head-on collision between the world that feminism has wrought and what it is that women really want. And that, I think, is a fascinating paradox. So, again, that complaint could just as well have been called the case against the metrosexual, because that's really what all these women are complaining about, is the sex man, essentially.
Right. I mean, in other words, just the very notion, I mean, marriage, you know, from time immemorial, well, but at least part of what one seeks in marriage for and has been for a long time has been a companion. And what makes for a good companion, it seems to me, one can think that you want as a companion someone who will sort of share, these traditional roles evenly. You know what I'm saying? So you think you want something in a companion, but in fact you want something else. And this goes back to my observation that I've made to some of my friends, female friends, that I feel that I can kind of fall back on kind of old cliches to kind of, you know, I don't know, reassure myself or at least palliate some of the unhappiness of marriage, which is inevitable. These are sort of typical kind of truisms about the difficulties of the male psyche or the difficulties of the female psyche and so on. And they're kind of sexist cliches, actually.
Right.
But feminism has kind of taken those cliches away from women for a way of thinking about men and themselves, for that matter.
This is the problem, is that these women live in a brave new world, many of them, where these kind of cliches are not allowed, and men and women are really not supposed to be different. Well, obviously, they are in fundamental ways, or else women wouldn't have created this confessional literature, which has no counterpart in the male world.
No, because I think...
Men are not...
Yeah, I think about I have difficulties with my wife, and I kind of realize, well, I'm just being a typical male egotist, you know, and seeing the world centered around me kind of thing. And that's kind of helpful to have that, you know. And I'm wondering whether feminism is sort of taken away. Well, I'm being a typical, you know, this or that woman. Because there's no such thing as a typical woman, right? In the feminist ideology. That's the whole point, is that what's considered a typical woman is socially constructed and something to be overcome. Yeah.
Right. So you can't picture these women going to their grandmothers for consolation, because their grandmothers are presumably going to tell them things that they don't believe. I mean, they believe that they're a brand new generation of women really creating reality anew. And if that is the case, then some of them seem to have made a mess of it. And I'm not saying it's all women's fault. Obviously, there are a lot of complicit men. I mean, when men rely on women to be co-breadwinners on the one hand, and then don't, you know, be the domestic tornadoes around the house that the women seem to want on the other hand, obviously, you know, the burden is falling disproportionately there.
Yeah.
But you're quite right. I mean, we moderns have sort of stripped away the pool of collective wisdom. We've taken away the pool of collective wisdom that shows up in cliches about the sexes, and we've deprived ourselves of what's in there.
Right. I mean, obviously the cliches can be kind of crude and unhelpful in their simplicity, but, you know, an intelligent person like Sandra Low is perfectly capable of using them in a plastic way, but if they're not available to her, then she has to kind of reinvent things on her own, and that's usually a recipe for disaster.
Yeah.
Especially for something so difficult as marriage. Well, your piece ends, you make you kind of muse a bit, and you draw on part of her tell-all story in The Atlantic to suggest that our kind of sex-saturated culture has a paradoxical effect of de-sexing or making romance less likely. You know, you make observations about pornography and so on as a kind of an escapist impulse, or providing an escape from sexual intimacy.
Yes, and I would like to emphasize that, Rusty, because I do think, although a lot of what's being described in their essays and mine is, you know, the eternal verities, the way people always are, I do think there is something really clear, and that is the role of pornography in all of this.
Mm-hmm.
And it's interesting because women allude to this. For example, in the Sandra Lowe essay, one of the women in an unhappy marriage knows all about her husband's pornography. It's bookmarked on the family computer, et cetera. There are other knowing references to pornography, to people viewing it, consuming it in one way or another, and yet nobody seems to connect the possible dots between all this consumption of pornography, which I realize is probably shocking to people over, say, 50,
mm-hmm.
60 maybe now, but to people who are 30 years old, 40 years old, I mean, this is the sea they swim in. It's full of pornography, and everyone is supposed to be sort of matter-of-fact about it. Outside the circles of religious believers, generally speaking, there are not objections to this sort of thing. I mean, there are objections to having children consume it or having children be on the production side of it. But generally speaking, polite opinion is that we're all supposed to be laissez-faire about this and understand that it's just the world we live in. Well, I think that viewing it that way is probably damaging a lot of marriages out there. And to judge by this confessional literature, it's happening right under the noses of women without their really being aware of it. Because, again, they have been, enlightened women today, have been sold a bill of goods, and they've been told that pornography doesn't matter. And then they find themselves in these marriages with no romance, can't figure out why their husbands have lost interest. Everybody's angry about it, but nobody is pointing to one possible and, I think, obvious culprit here, which is the consumption of pornography on today's scale.
Yeah, I mean, you draw the analogy between the pornography and the very, I thought, very perceptive observation, the disaffected husband who escapes into pornography versus the 50s cliche of the disaffected housewife who escapes into the romance novel. I found that a very convincing analogy, a kind of escapist mentality, a surrogate world of sexual satisfaction that doesn't really force one to confront the inevitable, as you point out, timeless problems of male-female relationships in marriage, you know, which there is
interesting. I mean, I think there's been an almost total inversion that way, say, since 1950 or so, where, in other words, the woman was the one most vulnerable to fantasy then, you know, through escapist novels, Harlequin romances. This was a really commercially huge genre for decades in America. And obviously they were escaping, to some extent, marital problems, hard work, whatever we escape from when we get into books. And I think that's happening now with pornography and men. Pornography offers them a chance to get away from it all and not deal with their wives in all senses.
Mm-hmm.
And simultaneously, we have women, to judge by this round of confessional literature that I was describing, we have women acting more like men, that is, sort of being very out there and upfront about the problems as they see them and being very angry and being very explicitly angry about not having sex-saturated marriages the way they want them. This is not a traditional female complaint. I mean, I don't think I'm going out on a limb and saying that it doesn't exactly reverberate through literature elsewhere. This is something very new to this female confessional literature that one finds in the blogosphere and the Better magazines and so on. So in that sense, too, I think there's been a reversal. And this is all very new, which means very interesting to study.
What do you, I mean, we get the low piece about the sort of tell-all about divorce and so on. Yet, it seems that the takeaway, so to speak, from this, when I was sort of stepping back and was saying, it's fascinating to me that the durability of marriage as a ideal, because that's true across all the folks you surveyed. Whether it's in the mode of disappointment and bitterness about its failure, or in the mode of the Flanagan piece, a kind of defense of it for the sake of children and so on, it does seem to endure.
Yes, and you know,
I mean, I had to laugh when you adduced various folks saying that, you know, marriage is you know, no longer a viable institution because of X, Y, or Z. I just had to laugh. I mean, these arguments have been around for 150 years without any really deep change in the way people approach. I mean, the lack of marriage doesn't seem to be, I mean, sort of educated people who ought to be the most sort of progressively minded and informed about these things are the most likely people to marry in our society.
Yes. And conversely, as sociologist Bradford Wilcox and other people have been showing, you know, marriage remains an ideal for those in whose cultures it is disappearing, in the ghetto culture, for example.
Mm-hmm.
If you ask women, at least, what they would really like out of life, they would love to get married and stay married. So it is an enduring ideal across cultures and subcultures. There's no doubt about that, and presumably that's because it answers to something deep inside all of us. The recognition of eternity, the need for eternity, you know, of which this is an earthly situation.
Mm-hmm.
If that is the case, then it's interesting to wonder whether the people who would like to have us retool marriage, you know, to be a sort of short-term contract to get in and out of more easily, whether those are people who have lost that sense of the eternal and whether that's really what might be driving this.
Mm-hmm.
But that's a big question for another day, probably.
Indeed. Well, thanks a lot for taking the time.
Thank you, Rusty.